Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. I'm talking today with someone who's a Conversations Live favorite, author of The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. And if you didn't guess already, I'm talking with Dan Millman. His latest book is Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit, The True Story of My Spiritual Quest. And I have to say, I love that title, Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit. I think that's something to strive for. As the title implies, Dan wrote his book to inspire readers on their own quests. He shares reflections on the extraordinary experiences that shaped his growth from youthful dreamer to spiritual teacher. For those who aren't familiar with his work, let me tell you a little bit more about him. Dan Millman teaches the Peaceful Warrior's Way around the world. He's the author of 18 books published in 29 languages. Dan Millman is a former world champion athlete, university coach, martial arts instructor, and college professor. And his original bestseller, Way of the Peaceful Warrior, was adapted to a feature film starring Nick Nolte. You can find out much more about Dan and his work at peacefulwarrior.com. So let me bring him right on here. There's a lot to talk about. Dan Millman and his book, Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit, The True Story of My Spiritual Quest. Well, Dan Millman, I believe this is the fourth time you've joined us on Conversations Live, and it's such an honor for me to kick off the new year with you. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Vicki. Every time is a first time for me.
So your new book, Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit, is appearing at the perfect time. Because after the last couple of years dealing with COVID and, all that went with that, from relationships to family problems and work problems and politics, people are really looking at their lives, their pre-COVID lives and their lives now, and asking, do I really want to go back to my pre-COVID life? So I think this is the perfect time, don't you?
Yes, and of course, the new year as well.
Yes, and I know you probably started working on this a long time ago. All of your work teaches an approach to living that you call the Peaceful Warrior's Way. Why did you want to write this now? This book is slightly different. It's a memoir. Why now?
Well, next month I turn 76 years old.
Oh, do you really?
I wanted to write the book while the memories were fresh, while I still had some memories. and it seemed like a good culmination of a writing career to finish with the true story behind the story of my life and work. Now, I can't presume that everyone in the world needs to read about my individual story. We each have our stories that are have our adventures and significant elements. But I also wanted to convey some fundamental ideas, as you know, having seen it, about the quest for happiness, fulfillment, the spiritual search. And so I thought this, and also my books have mixed fact and fiction. Way of the Peaceful Warrior, my best-known book, was a blend of autobiography with fictional elements. So this was the first book that I can say is entirely true and accurate as much as I could possibly express. There was no fiction in it. And so for many people, it may be revelatory.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if it was hard for you to bear everything, if you will. Did you find that difficult as a writer, as a human being?
Not really. My life has always been an open book. The only reason I mixed some fictional elements in my first book and best-known book is because I wanted to convey lessons and also tweak the story a bit to capture people's interest. So I decided to use that approach. I had no idea what the response would be, but it has started a new genre of semi-fictional autobiographies. But memoir needs to have no fiction. If it's truly a memoir, it has to be based on one's best memories. And that's what I've done with a new book.
Right, right. And for those who are new to your work, you know, because we're having new generations come and be aware of things all the time, your teachings come from decades of training in gymnasts, in martial arts, and with guides and mentors that you met along the way. So, I mean, there's a great deal of wisdom that you've accumulated over the years, whether it's somebody else's and you've interpreted it in your own way, or whether it's a realization of your own. So I think this is perfect timing. And I've always been a huge fan of your work, but now I guess I'm at a point where I really, really understand it and appreciate it. Do you find that with some people?
Well, I do. I wanted to convey, many people who, you know, seen the Peaceful Warrior movie based on the first book or read the book, they sort of imagine me as this young fellow who was an athlete, and then somehow he got from A to Z and began
right.
teaching about spiritual elements. But as you've seen from the book, I had decades of intensive training, preparation. So I wanted to share my lineage, so to speak. And everyone has one. Many teachers leave people with the idea that they somehow had this divine inspiration and they started teaching all this wisdom. But most of us do have shoulders on which we stand. And it just happened that the four primary mentors that I cover in the book were archetypal figures as well, you know, that I call the professor, the guru, the warrior priest, and finally the sage. And they represent different aspects of our spiritual search. And I just happen to have these real-life teachers in order that was meant to be, I suppose. And I don't teach their teachings. They just open doors for me of insight and inspiration so I can teach this approach to living. And, you know, I use the term peaceful warrior, as you know, but not all your listeners may, to really refer to all of us. It's not some exclusive club. And one doesn't have to have had martial arts or gymnastics or even other athletic experience.
Right.
It's just that was my peculiar preparation. Other people, it's through music or mathematics or other means. But I did want to convey something that everyone could relate to. Many people have had teachers like the professor or like the guru or like one of the others. But the four were a particularly beneficial combination that convey a cautionary tale, in a sense, and some guidance on our own searches in life.
Mm. I want to talk about those a little in more detail in just a while. I want to, first of all, just share what warrior spirit means to you, because, you know, many people... for me, that would cover somebody on a horse, you know, charging. But I mean, there's many ways to interpret this. So tell us, for the purposes of the book, Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit, what you mean by warrior spirit.
Sure. I'm happy to do that. As I said before, I view all of us as peaceful warriors in training, because each of us is striving to live in our own way with a more peaceful heart amidst the chaos of everyday life and change, to live with a sense of equanimity and serenity and so on, and balance. And yet, there are times we need a warrior spirit. And what I mean by that, it's not necessarily about fighting, except perhaps the battle with some of our inner demons, insecurity, self-doubt, and that sort of thing, and fear in different forms. But really, the warrior spirit is about rolling up our sleeves and marching into life. Because I view the earth as a divine school for souls, let's say, and daily life is our classroom. We're given challenges every day, small or large, and over time, sometimes quite challenging. And we don't have to pretend to like them, but we should recognize that every form of difficulty and adversity that we tackle, because we have to, essentially, makes us a little wiser, a little stronger, and expands our sense of perspective. So that's what I mean by peaceful warrior, peaceful heart, and that bringing that sense of spirit, that standing up inside of ourselves, standing tall, and rolling up our sleeves and marching into life and taking on those challenges as a form of spiritual weight training. Because if you don't lift any weights, you don't get any stronger.
Right. Right. I love that. There's a quote in the book that I really like too. It's by Louisa May Alcott. She says, "I have less fear of storms now that I'm learning how to sail my ship." And really, that's what this is all about. One of the reasons I love your work is that you acknowledge it's an approach and it's a practice, you know, not some seven-step guide to fixing life, period.
Exactly. Precisely. It's a process. I'm still practicing, of course. You know, a Customano, a boxing coach, once said that heroes and cowards, and this obviously applies to men and women equally, they all experience the same fears. They just respond differently. Mm. So this approach that I teach, that I've learned as an amalgam of all these different teachers I've had, is that we have more control over what we actually do, how we move our arms and legs, and what we say. That's an action as well. We have more control over what we do in life than what emotions or thoughts pass through us, appear and disappear, arise in consciousness. But so many of us are trying to fix our mind and have just the right emotion so that we can be motivated enough to do whatever it is we need to do, whereas there is an approach to living. It's really liberating when you actually practice it for a bit, is to accept our thoughts and feelings as natural to us in the moment, whether they're positive or negative, but still focus on the main question, which is, what do I need to do right now? And go and do it.
Mm. And that kind of leads into a question I was going to ask about monkey mind. You know, people talk about taming their gremlins, their inner voice, their head talk, whatever they call it. Everybody calls it something differently. What do you say about taming that and your approach to it?
Well, yes, it is quite different. Obviously, people tend to think of meditation or other insight work to somehow tame the mind, to make it quiet and no longer troubling to us. But I've come to fully accept not only my emotions, and I have all kinds of emotions throughout the day or week or month or year, as do all of us. But rather than taming it in a way that you try to subjugate or insist that the mind be quiet or only have positive thoughts, I'm more realistic than that. Because even after having done meditations of various kinds, as you know, having read the book, it's not about having the quiet mind. It's mm-hmm. about having a quiet body. And when the body is relaxed, which most people's experience when they do meditation or other deep relaxation exercises, when the body is quiet, the mind tends to follow suit. And our thoughts come and go, but as most of us are starting to realize, it's not, thoughts aren't the problem. You know, thoughts happen to us. They simply appear in our consciousness, these random thoughts that pop up, again, positive or negative. And we don't say, I think I'll think this thought next. They just simply arise, we notice them, as we would in meditation, and then we turn our attention back, yes, I'm having that thought, it's positive, it's negative, whatever, this doubt, this belief, this association, and now what do I need to do? And it simplifies life radically. This is what I learned from the fourth of my four mentors, the sage. He brought me back down to earth after I visited all the metaphysical realms and experienced these sophisticated, challenging techniques of breath and body work and mind. And I came back to earth in terms of realizing that I tame my mind by accepting it fully, but not letting it run the show. Mm. Just the thoughts happen, and meanwhile, what do I need to do now?
A couple of other things where you teach a little differently to many people who teach similar kind of work in this field, if you will. One of them is ego. You say it's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. It's not something we need to get rid of. It's there to transcend. Would you talk to us about that?
Sure. And as I do repeat in the book, the warrior priest presented some deep wisdom from the Hawaiian Huna teaching. The kahunas are medicine people who are very, very good at healing and awareness. They talked about three selves: the conscious self, which we generally locate in or around our head; the higher self, which is the sentient being, some say, in the metaphysical traditions, that stands above and around us, that is our source of inspiration, our connection to spirit, and the basic self, which is around our vital area or belly, which is in charge of the body. It's like a very powerful child, 4 to 7 year old child, call it our inner child or subconscious mind. And so when we talk about the ego, in terms of your question, it's really the conscious self. Its purpose is learning, is growing up from childhood, infancy and childhood, into adulthood, constantly learning about life and adapting to life in a realistic way. So it's our sense of identity. It's a coat hanger for experience, an organizing principle. When Freud coined the term ego, it was just ich. It was the German word I. It didn't have a negative connotation, but today, in spiritual circles, if someone tells me, Dan, you have a huge ego, it's not necessarily considered a compliment.
Mm.
But the ego is simply a sense of self. We're not here to get rid of the ego, or we would just kind of be gazing into space and drooling. We're here to transcend it, and there's a big difference. We transcend this illusion of a separate self through insight and humor. Meditation can bring that insight. We see what we're up to deeply over time, all these random thoughts, the nature of this monkey mind, as you say, and we begin to see through it and not take ourselves or the mind quite as seriously, which is why Lao Tzu once said, as soon as you have a thought, laugh at it.
Yeah, I love that.
We don't mistake it for reality. We see it just as this stuff arising, beliefs, associations, projections. Well, a writer named Barbara Rasp once said, the lesson is simple, the student is complicated.
Ah,
and we complicate our lives with all these ideas of the ego. In ancient times, we used to blame the devil. Oh, the devil made me do it if we've misbehaved. But today, we're much more sophisticated. Now we go, oh, my ego made me do it, and I have to get rid of this thing, as if it's something floating around inside of us we have to conquer. And it's just a sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we recognize we also are or have this higher self and the basic self, we exist on these different levels, it makes our life function much better. And so that's what I would say about this notion of the ego. It's a part of who we are, but we just need to see through it as well.
Let's talk about these first two mentors that you've talked about, the professor, Bolivian scientist mystic, and the guru, who's an American-born spiritual master. They inspired you through their work, through their teachings. They influenced you in ways that inspired you to write your first book. So tell us how that happened. I know you talked somewhere about, or maybe I heard you talking about this once where I think it was in your book, where how the first 3 decades of your life, you were ripening, and then suddenly you were ready to absorb this information.
Well, that seems to be how it worked out. In the Hindu tradition, there's they say the first, of course, people didn't live as long then, so it was the first 20 years were for education, the second 20 years becoming a householder, perhaps marrying or raising a family, and getting, you know, a career and work and service. And the third 20 years toward the end of life was for wisdom, for approaching spirituality and life's bigger picture. And that was one approach. But in my own case, yes, my athletic days as a boy and a young man in college and my coaching days were all sorts of preparations for teaching and for learning and the process of life. And somehow they opened me up to these first two mentors you mentioned. And chronologically, yes, I did not write Way of the Peaceful Warrior until I had studied with the professor, which was a finite time, but very intensive. It began with a 40-day training, 40 days in a row, 10 hours a day, full-time immersive work, and an amazing array of a global heritage of spiritual practices. A technological approach, an objective approach that didn't require belief in a particular thing, unlike, for example, religious belief and faith, which is certainly a very respectable area of life. But this was more the professor having a scientific constitution and having studied deeply the anatomy and physiology of the human being and psychology in depth himself, wanted to present an objective school that if you just go through it, you get processed if you do the exercises. And so that was the first 40-day, then there was an advanced training and additional trainings after that. You name it, in terms of breath work and breathing, you know, every kind of meditation, 50 different kinds of meditation, from that imagining spirals of light going around every part of the body to breathing one time a minute while imagining a pellet of light going up the spine and then down the frontal canal of the body. Many very sophisticated models of levels of consciousness and doors of the psyche, how we release tension. And I highlight some of these in the book, as you know. So that was one approach to spiritual life. And the bone massage that I wrote about in Way of the Peaceful Warrior, the Mongolian warrior massage, came from the professor, as did some other basic ideas of body and mind. Well, I wanted to convey to readers why I was attracted to these teachers, almost so readers would feel a sense of, oh, I wish I'd had that teacher. But then I also explained why I moved on, why I wasn't, there was a firewall between all these techniques I was doing and everyday life. I was going through marriage difficulties. Many people know I was married once for 8 years when a young man, and before I found the love of my life after that. And Joy and I have been together 46 years.
Well, congratulations on that. That's a feat.
Well, thank you. Thank you. But also, Joy does, as you know, weigh in. She actually added commentaries in the book. After she'd read 8 drafts of the book, she said, you know, Dan, maybe I ought to just say a few things here and there about my perceptions. And I said, you went with me through all the mentors, so yes, that's a great idea. And so she also offers commentaries in the book. But then after I met the guru, who was a genuine, you know, had the mojo, the juice, as a spiritual master, who through whom you could relate to the divine directly through this personage, he was highly respected as a writer. He wrote some brilliant works on every conceivable topic. Now, people may wonder, hearing this, who was this guy? And it's not as if I'm not telling their real identities. In the book, I reveal those right off the bat.
Yeah.
But I don't want to give people a preliminary view of who. If then they look them up on Wikipedia, they'll see things that are very positive about them, very negative about them, and they form a preconception. So that's why I don't say too much about them at first, but at the end of the book, I have a link. People can go and learn much more about each one if they're interested, as well as photos and from my life. So after these two approaches, technological and then the relationship with this guru, which I had for almost 8 years, it was a whole way of life. That's when I was prepared to write Way of the Peaceful Warrior, and the second two mentors affected all the other books.
Yes, it's interesting. And of course, you talk about them in archetypal roles because people do come to us that way. I can think of somebody in my life that I automatically thought of as a sage the minute I met her. And she was older, but it wasn't just the fact that she was older. It was her approach and her thinking that made me feel that way about her.
Exactly.
I want to talk a little about potential because I've heard you say that, you know, and especially now I'm hearing it, you're probably hearing it too, Dan, where people say, you know, the last 2 years have been so difficult and many people are embracing that in some ways. You know, there are things they're appreciating about waking up and realizing certain things need to change. But, you know, I've also on the flip side heard people say they're frustrated because they feel they're not living up to their potential. And you have a different perspective on that too. I wonder if you'd share that with us.
Sure. There was a fellow who came to me once and said, you know, I want to unleash my power, and I'm going really hard, and I'm accomplishing a lot, but I just don't know if I'm doing 100%, and how can I reach my potential? And I said, well, what if you knew that you reached your potential yesterday or this morning, and the rest of the time you just get to enjoy life and your momentum and continue to explore and achieve, but maybe you have reached your potential. I said that, not that I knew it or could predict it, but I wanted them to consider that, because otherwise it's crazy making. Like, whatever we're doing, we can be doing more. And this idea of potential gives us this idealistic thing to compare ourselves with. And one of the takeaways that I hope readers get from the book is that it's time to stop comparing ourselves to other people. Because as soon as we compare ourselves to someone else, we're going to either feel superior or inferior, depending on who we compare ourselves to. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, even comparing ourselves to ourselves, our younger self, I used to be able to do this, or I was so happy back when, it's, again, a form of suffering. And it's a profound disrespect for our process. As a young coach, I found that some people learn to somersault easier than other people. They learned it faster. But those who took longer to learn it often learned that somersault better than those who learned it more quickly. So each of us needs to respect our own life, our own process. And one of the key elements in this approach I teach, called the Peaceful Warrior's Way, is that there is no best book, including mine, no best teacher, no best philosophy or religion or form of exercise or martial art. There is only the best for each of us at a given time of our life. Life is an experiment. We have to find out what works for us. So this way is based upon a profound respect for our own process and how our life unfolds, not trying to live someone else's or some idealized potential.
Right, right. I want to talk a little bit about self-sabotage, because many of us are our own worst enemy. And of course, your work really, all of your books really kind of deal with this to some extent. There's a story I remember, and I honestly don't remember if it was in the book or if I read it in one of your other books, but you talk about the story of a man who climbs a sacred mountain to ask for energy. He wants to get more energy, and he wants the mountain to shine light on him. And a voice tells him, "I'm always filling you up, but you keep leaking." I wonder if you'd tell us, because you say you're practicing this daily yourself, what are some ways that you might leak energy? What are some ways we need to be aware of fixing?
Sure. The two primary, because we're surrounded by spirit, by beauty, by inspiration, every day, every moment. It's just that we don't always notice it. So there's plenty of, the weather person doesn't say, 20% chance of rain today, and let's say 32% spirit out. It's always here. But we get preoccupied with our own inner ruminations. What am I going to do about my relationship, my health, my finances, my career decisions, and so on? And so we don't often have the free attention to look at the world with the eyes of a child again. Maybe if we travel to an exotic place, we wake up for a little while. So this idea of leaking is that there is always spirit around, but we leak in two ways. One is unnecessary tension. We often find this chronic tendency to tighten our thighs, our stomach, our backs. We carry chronic tension, so it's important to work with the body and do deep relaxation and get some body work now and then to start opening the body and relaxing and not wasting energy. Because we get energy from people around us, from the sun, from food we eat. It's always there. The other energy leak is unconscious inhibition of breathing. Now, some people go, well, why do you need breathing practices? Just in and out, that's all you need to know. And we breathe naturally. And that's true in a sense, but the mind imposes tension on the body. And we don't breathe as naturally as a six-month-old child who just learned to sit up in their little belly going in and out. Diaphragmatic breathing, natural breathing. We tend to breathe in our upper chest through tension and so on. So also, throughout the day, we're meant to breathe like a pendulum. And the depth of the breath is dependent on our activity level. But we're meant to breathe smoothly and evenly, but we unconsciously hold our breath many times during the day. Trust me on this. I don't have time to go into it now. But by focusing on breathing naturally in a relaxed way and relaxing the body, not wasting energy, we naturally begin to experience all the energy we need for the day. That doesn't mean I don't take a nap now and then. At my age, I do, like an old dog. I'm a believer in power naps, but I think having learned to relax and to breathe more evenly when we stand up, when we sit down, when we're at the computer, just even relaxed breathing, these simple practices we can bring into everyday life are what I like to focus on.
I love it. There's so much I want to talk to you about, but we're running short on time here. I wanted just to say that you mentioned how your wife Joy helped you throughout the book, and there's a little box with Joy's memories in it. She says, over the passing years, my relationship with Dan has grown deeper and richer. He was my own mentor in many ways. And I've heard you say the same thing about her, that she's ultimately been your greatest teacher. So maybe that's why you've been married as long as you have.
I think so. We sometimes tell each other we're the only people on the planet who could live with each other. Well, many married couples understand that idea.
Yes. Yeah. So I know listeners can find out much more about you at your website, peacefulwarrior.com. And the book is called got too much paperwork here. I want to make sure I get the full title in here. Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit. And they can find out, of course, much more about you and your work there, Dan. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I did hint at it earlier, but I would say, again, remember to trust yourself and trust your process. Even faith, F-A-I-T-H, faith is the courage to live as if everything that happens is for our highest good in learning. And we're going to come out of this difficult time, all of us, with a new appreciation for everyday life.
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned quite a bit is humor. And I think we all need to get our sense of humor back, take ourselves a little less seriously, as you say, and learn to laugh a little bit more. Dan Millman, always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Same here. Thank you.
And again, the book is called Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit, The True Story of My Spiritual Quest, and it is a memoir. You can find much more about Dan at his website, peacefulwarrior.com. If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.